Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Gerard Vyhenko. He is the author of Discipline, the Play. The book is a madcap of comedy with a sympathetic mix of wit, banter, love, frustration, and it really flirts with the wit of the obsessions that can drive a man to madness. Let's find out if it really does. But first, a little bit about Gerard Vyhenko. Gerard is an award-winning author of the mystery thriller, The Dealmaster. His second book, a tragic comedy, is titled Discipline. And this is the one that we're going to be talking about today because it is just hot off the press. And believe it or not, it has already earned the Editor's Choice Award from iUniverse, his publisher. New York theater critic Christopher Kompanik calls the work compelling. And West Coast Reader Views reviewer Paige Lovett says, Discipline truly made me laugh out loud. She goes on to say, it is a quirky, fun, and very unique book to read. Gerard holds degrees in studio art and creative writing from the University of Southern Maine. He is a Brooklyn, New York born and bred and now lives in Portland, Maine with Katerina and their two pups. Hi, Gerard.
Hi, Irene.
Well, this is great to be talking to you and your new book, which is kind of written differently. It's really a novel, but it's in a play. So before we actually talk more, I'd like you to just sort of explain to the listening audience, the concept of this being a play.
It didn't start out as a play.
Uh-huh.
Discipline started out as a short story. I'm a novelist and a short story writer. But there was so much dialogue involved. And I thought, I love plays. I love attending plays. But why not just turn this into a play and let's see what happens? It was one of those things where, you want your child to be this and they turn out to be that.
Yes. That's what happened.
Yeah.
Well, you address some social norms in this book, and I would just like you to talk about social norms that I guess we anticipate or place in our minds what social norms are. And, your social norms might be one thing, mine are something else, and the listener to this has a social norm of something else. So,
social norms are rules, that they define, they're either explicit or they're implicit. And they define appropriate and inappropriate behavior. Going out to a restaurant and eating food with your fingers, that's inappropriate behavior.
And
everyone knows that, and everyone accepts that, and most people can cope with these rules.
Uh-huh.
But there are some people who have difficulty coping with rules. And Harold, my main character in the play, he's a free spirit, he's a good guy, and it doesn't hurt anyone. But he's trying to live his life by his own set of rules, and society won't let him. And so this causes frustration. Society keeps him restrained, making him live a life of discipline. And this frustration eventually gets the best of him and slips up, and that's when he gets into trouble.
So what is his major frustration?
Well, Harold is basically the kind of guy that would just love to do what he wants to do. It's almost like, the beauty of Harold is that there's a little bit of us in Harold. We would like to get up when we wanted to get up and go to work when we wanted to go to work, that kind of thing. Say things to people that you wouldn't normally say. Well, Harold doesn't have those restrictions. And, there's one scene, his lady love, Lily, at one point in the play, she makes reference to a time when Harold was locked up because he was caught running nude through Central Park. Harold. He's out there, but like I said, he's trying to just live his life. The biggest frustration that Harold has is that he doesn't understand how society can look at him and type him and put him into a, you know, put a label on him.
Well, isn't that something that most of us feel anyway? You know, I realize that this is your character that you're talking about, but as I'm listening to what you're saying, I relate to a lot of the things that you said. It's like, you know, society expects certain things, and then we can break that down into cultural. Certain cultures have their own set of rules as well.
Absolutely, and it starts very young, right from the beginning. You know, I can remember, and I hear people do it all the time. When a child is very small, they say, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Right.
As if there's only one thing that you can be.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so society wants to put a person in a box. They want to type to them. They say, okay, this is a jeweler. This is an author. You can't be both.
You
have to be one or the other. Whereas if you study, you go back into the Renaissance period. You know, that's what got me. I looked at these guys when I was studying art, as a young guy.
Uh-huh.
Wow, look at this. These guys can do anything and everything. Why is that?
Yeah.
Well, because society didn't put them in a box. They said, you are an artist. And as an artist, you can make jewelry, you can sculpt, you can paint, you can cook, you can...
Uh-huh.
And so they had the freedom to be that way. And this play, you know, calls society up and says, hey, look, you know, yeah, it's exaggerated. Here's a guy who's doing whatever he wants to do, and I understand you can't do that. But on the other hand, there's a lot of subtleties here that really need to be addressed.
Yeah, as I was listening to you talking, and it's these imprints that, you know, come. And the thing is, those imprints can come to us not only from our own childhood, but they are passed down for generations on how, you know, I remember my grandparents telling me, you know, I wanted to be a nurse. As a little girl, for some reason, I found out, I guess, what nurses do, and I wanted to be a nurse. And I remember my grandmother telling me, why do you want to be a nurse? All they do is carry around bedpans.
Yeah.
And that stuck in me because, you know, she just, and of course, as we know, they don't do that anymore. They used to, I guess, probably in her era. But so a lot of these, and then you talked about rules too. You know, what is it? Why you're talking about Renaissance period where an artist can be an artist in anything, but all of a sudden we started over time, something changed, and we're narrowing it down to, you know, a very small portion. Okay, so you're an artist. So is an artist that all you can do is paint? Like, what happened?
Yeah, I think what happened is that through education, they wanted to, you know, in France, you have to declare what it is that you want to be at a very young age. I mean, you think we have it hard over here. Over there, they have to do that, and that's where they go. In fact, I heard a statistic here in the United States that X amount of percent, I don't know, 70-80% of the people who get a job straight out of high school, that's the job or that's the profession that they're going to be in for the rest of their lives.
Well, yeah, I don't know what the statistics is now. That used to be at one time because, remember, well, maybe I'm really dating myself, but I remember, you know, if you got a job with a company like, let's say, IBM, and you were set for life because you would work there for 35 years and you would retire and, you know, you get your retirements and that was it. But things changed and, whoops, people started being laid off. They were replaced with computers or the work was outsourced. And these people started coming out of places like IBM, and they couldn't get another job because they couldn't do anything else.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And so that's certainly boxing. So I think that things have changed. Now, your Howard is...
Harold.
Harold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He is in constant state of sexual frustration. Is this kind of a guy thing?
It's not so much a guy thing as it is part of the exaggeration of his frustrations. You know, he's, you know, his behavior is, in one way, revolting against the boundaries that lock him in. He feels trapped, and he expresses these frustrations by acting out, you know, the same way a child would when he's scolded and he's not able to do what he wants. You know, sometimes when you, and Harold has that very childlike nature, and sometimes when you tell a child, you know, don't do this, first thing they do is that.
Like
the Garden of Eden thing. Don't eat from that tree. Okay, pluck. There you go. So that's part of it. And one of the things, too, that the whole sexual overindulgence does for Harold, it takes his mind off where he is, who he is, and he's, because essentially he's, he lives in Manhattan in an apartment with his lady love, but essentially he's alone, as we all are. As, you know, the play points out, basically, you know, you're alone when you come into this world, you're alone when you go out, and you know what? You're pretty much alone, even if you live with someone. So this overindulgence, or what he would like to be, you know, sexually overindulged, this helps him to get away, to draw his... He has dreams. He has bad dreams. He has nightmares. And he tells Lily, this lady love, that he said, you know, when I have nightmares, he said, I think about your breasts. And that helps me. She tells him, you know, I'm glad they serve a purpose.
When you talk about sexual overindulgence, just tell our listeners what it is that you mean. Do you, what does that mean to you?
Well, everything that he does sort of revolves around sex when he talks to Lily. That a lot of the action takes place in bed. And you know, and he's always asking her to, you know, he wants to make love, and she is his conscience, and you know, she's the disciplinarian. You know, she says we can't do that. You know, we have to have discipline. Where the title comes from. Because if we continually do that, you get out of hand, and that's what gets you in trouble. So you need to have discipline. You need to just... You know. And so, you know, he takes matters into his own hands, which gets him into trouble as well. But you know, she even stops him from doing that because he's told by society that that's what you... You know, you can't do that. You can't be that way.
Well, then I'm wondering, too, Gerard, when you're talking about sexual overindulgence and, you know, is there a fine line between that and what some are perceived to be sexual addiction? You know, this is a very prominent thing. Sexual addiction is finally coming out into the limelight and it's being talked about. And so I'm wondering if your character is sexually addicted.
There's a fine line between inappropriate and appropriate behavior. And we all of us, you know, step over the line occasionally. But if you step over that line too many times, suddenly people are labeling you, which is something you have to watch out for.
Labels there again. And that's societal, it's cultural.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Gerard Bianco, author of Discipline. What can be more of a tragic comedy than reality? And I'm sure that we can relate to many of the things discussed so far. Stay tuned because there's just so much more. It's back again to what you had said in the beginning, rules. We create rules. Sometimes we create the rules that nobody knows about. We just create them in our own heads. And then so then there's judgment.
Right. Yeah, we talk about judgment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't judge. Don't judge anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
We can't help it. We are born to judge. Everything that we do, from the moment we open our eyes in the morning, when we go to step out of the bed, we are making a judgment. We are judging how far away from the bed is the floor,
yeah,
so we don't fall over.
Yeah.
We are judging it immediately. You know, should I put on my robe? Is it cold? Is it hot? Is it hot? You know, and everything that you do after that, you may do it by rote, but in reality, you are judging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that goes into, you know, when you look at somebody in the street walking up, you know, how's he dressed?
Mm-hmm.
Boppy, is he a bum? Is he, you know, you don't want to judge him, but suddenly, boom, there it is. You have an impression. And that impression comes from social norms.
Yeah, exactly. Social norms. And also, it seems that social norms allow some people to actually, you know, treat people adversely if they have some type of an affliction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Society is not very tolerant of those people with an affliction.
No, no.
Yeah, especially those with a mental disorder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of us. Oh, I'm sorry, did I say us? There are a lot of people who have, you know, a mental disorder.
Sure.
You know, some very small and can cope with it, and some fairly large.
Mm.
And because, you know, we're so far behind in our understanding of how the brain works, people with a mental disorder are sometimes treated like cattle.
Yeah.
You know, they're grouped according to what doctors believe their
mm-hmm.
disorder is. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And again, boom, they put labels on them. Who is bipolar, who's schizophrenic, who has a personality disorder.
That's right, labels. And it seems that, I don't know if this seems like this to you, but for me it seems to me there's a trend. You know, for a long time it was ADD, and then it was ADHD, and then it's bipolar, and then it's schizophrenia. And, you know, I'm hearing more and more people being diagnosed with schizophrenia. And then the latest thing, it seems to me, Asperger's disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, autism, but then the other form of it is Asperger's, and I'm hearing more and more. It's like all of a sudden these people are just being tunneled into these boxes.
Right.
And labeled.
Exactly. And so in the play, this is one of Harold's biggest frustrations.
Mm-hmm.
Is how can they understand who I really am?
Yeah.
If they don't know me, do they come here for dinner? Do they watch how I cook? Do they watch me iron, wash, do my clothes? And then he says, does anyone really know another person?
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why he gets frustrated.
Now, what about Lily? What does she represent as a woman in our society?
You know, for centuries, women's role in literature, you know, has been portrayed as both forces of good and evil. Really represents Harold's conscience. She's the disciplinarian. She is the one. She's the dominant figure. She wears the pants in the family. She's smarter. She's the smarter of the two. And it's her job to hold on to the reins that keep poor Harold in check. You know? And the banter between Harold and Lily is one of the driving forces in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Their banter and the wit that goes back and forth.
Well, you know, a lot of times people laugh when it comes to things like this. It's because it's such real banter. It's reality.
That's right.
And that's what makes it funny, is because it is real. And I'm sure that somebody, you know, if this came into the real play or anybody that's reading this book, if they are laughing, they've actually probably experienced that themselves.
That's the whole idea of this.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, Harold is unhappy. And as if you've ever read Samuel Beckett's play, Endgame,
mm-hmm.
there's a character there, Nell, And she says, nothing is funnier than unhappiness. It's the most comical thing in the world.
But it's kind of like, you know, it's almost an oxymoron, isn't it?
Well, you know, we do it all the time. There's TV shows, there's, you know, this play is, you know, billed as a comedy, but it's in reality, it's a tragic comedy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, movies that we watch, TV shows, MASH, you know, Catch-22. These are all tragic comedies.
Yeah.
Life
yeah.
is Beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a great movie, but
mm-hmm.
it's a tragic. Even goes back to, you know, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, that man was committing suicide.
Exactly.
He was so depressed. That's a tragic comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what, you know, and then you have great figures,
mm-hmm.
characters, you know, who... You know, Punch and Elbow and famous mime Marcel Marceau, Inspector Clouseau.
Yeah, right.
Lucy, on I Love Lucy. That was a tragic comedy figure that we all loved and laughed at.
And still do.
And still do.
Yeah.
We laughed at her when things were really going bad for her.
Mm-hmm.
Best loved and most famous of all the tragic comics is Charlie Chaplin's The Tramp.
Yeah, yeah.
They're so real.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this guy, and things just never go right for him, and it is so funny.
Yeah.
Fortunately, a lot of his movies end really well, so you
yeah.
walk away feeling good about it, you know, but that's not the way life is, unfortunately.
And, you know, social norms, they come from personal belief systems. And we all have them, and as we had talked earlier, they're imprints. They're maybe something that, you know, is societal or something that is talked about or believed in the family. And there's certainly advantages and disadvantages of having a personal belief system. And so I'd like to hear some comments on what you feel about personal belief systems.
The persona is what Carl Jung thought of as a public self. Now listen to this. He believed that people are the ones who play a role in the drama of life, and society is the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the writer,
mm-hmm.
when you look at things that way, your writing takes on a totally different slant.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you're writing a play, a short story, or a novel.
Yeah, yeah.
The writer's job is to create and write about characters and shape them with their beliefs. Then the writer creates situations whereby the character can reveal themselves through those beliefs, and that's showing, not telling, and that's the best type of writing.
You know, and that just what you said is so true, and I think I believe too that TV shows, the reality shows that have been around, I guess probably the first one started with about 10 years ago, but it was the only one for a while, and then all of a sudden it's like, you know, you turn on the TV and there's always some type of a reality show going on. And I think that this is the same kind of a thing where people relate to what is going on. And that's why they're so popular, because they can put themselves into that character, no different than what your character, you know, the reader could put themselves into either Harold or into Lily.
Every story, every mythology, every mythological story from the beginning of time until now is about the reader.
Yeah.
Not about the characters. It's all about the reader.
Yeah.
Who am I in this? You know, what character am I?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is it, you know, can I learn from looking at myself in this position?
Yeah.
That's, you know, if you can accomplish that, that's a great thing.
Exactly. And I so agree. But that, you know, that's life too. And so that's why we enjoy reading that kind of a book or watching that kind of a series on TV or a movie, is because we can put ourselves into that character.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you are so right. And that's what makes good writing and good entertainment, but it's also a reflection of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And
the great thing to do as a writer, you know, is to take this character and then, you know, have a dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, you know, at the end, come up with an ending that is a little surprising, or
mm-hmm.
something that perhaps the the reader may not have thought of. And that's being a mystery writer, you know, that's keep it going right up until the end, you know. And that's what happens here in Discipline as well. You know, at the end, Harold is faced with a dilemma. How does he take action here, you know?
So, Gerard, many authors, when writing, they portray some of their own life or experiences into the story. Did this happen to you?
Yes.
Yes.
I remember one time my father had passed away, and I thought, you know, I like to write poetry, and I said I'm going to write a poem about my dad. And I sat down to write this thing, and it just flowed and flowed and flowed and came out, and I went back and I read it. It was all about me. It wasn't about myself.
Yeah.
And this story of discipline, this was written. This was written from the heart because of family experience.
Sure, sure, great.
Yeah, you know, way to do it is firsthand.
Exactly, exactly. I so agree. And gosh, Gerard, this has been really an interesting conversation. And tell our listening audience what your website address is.
It's very easy. It's GerardBianco.com. GerardBianco.com.
Great. And thank you so much for taking the time, talking to us, talking about your newest book, Discipline, the Play. And readers, I just really encourage you to check this book out. Our reviewer, Paige Lovett, loved the book. She laughed. And one thing is that when you do read it, just you have to consider that this is a play. So it is different type of reading. But once you get the hang of it, I know that you'll just thoroughly enjoy it. Again, Gerard, thank you so much for coming online with us and talking about your newest book, Discipline.
Irene, thank you, and best of luck.
Thank you. And this is Irene Watson for Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.